We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal. Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. It has become a common assumption that the dominant powers of this century will be the United States, China, and India. Now, our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Andrew Muravchik, he's professor of politics and international affairs at Princeton. He says that that is nonsense. He says that right now there are only two global superpowers. They are the United States and Europe. And he says this will remain true for the foreseeable future. In fact, he says that European power is rising. Next time, and this morning here on Focus 580, we'll be talking about why it is that Europe and not China or India is the second superpower of the 21st century. This is the subject of a talk that our guest will be giving here on the campus this afternoon. It is part of the MillerCom series. He is hosted in part here on the campus by the European Union Center. A lot of other people have contributed to his visit here. If you're interested in hearing him and you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you need to stop by the Knight Auditorium that's at the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. He'll be giving his talk this afternoon at 4 o'clock. All of these events, MillerCom events, they're always free and open to the public. So anybody who is interested should stop by. As we talk here this morning, anyone interested in joining the conversation can pick up the telephone and dial the numbers here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Also, you have the option of email. You may send your emails to will-talk@illinois.edu. Just help us if you can keep them brief. And in fact, we hope that people in their comments will be brief just so we can get as many people in as possible and keep things moving along. Again, as I mentioned, Andrew Muravchik is professor of politics and international affairs. He's also director of the European Union program at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. He's also held similar positions at Harvard University. He's a non-resident senior fellow of the Brookings Institution and contributing editor of Newsweek magazine, and has written a lot of pieces that have appeared in scholarly publications and also in popular ones, Newsweek included. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much, David.
We appreciate it. Let me get at this, basic idea, and I think that it is the case, and you see it a lot in what's written about world affairs, people writing about the rising power of India and China, and they say that if not now, well, it will be in the near future that we will have, we'll be going back to more of a multipolar world, and the poles will be the United States and also these two Asian powers. But you say no, that's not the case.
Well, at the very least, it's very premature, maybe a half century or a century premature. I think the view that China and India are the other great superpowers in the world is based on a 19th century view about how international relations works. It's a view that you might have held in 1850 if you looked out at the international system and you said, what countries are powerful? You might have said a country with a big population or a country with a big aggregate GNP. And why would you have thought that way in 1850? Well, you would have calculated that international power comes from military power, and the way you get military power is to take a large population and a large GNP, extract resources, military manpower, and tax receipts, create an army, and project international power. But that's not the way it happens today. Today, international power comes by trading with other countries, by signing international agreements, and if you're using military power, by exploiting high technology effectively. And that kind of international power comes from countries that are adept at high technology, that have a high per capita income. And those countries are not countries like China and India and are not going to be for some time to come. And then that's why when we look at actual power projection in the world today, we see that Europe and the United States, rather than China and India, are far the dominant superpowers in the world. Let's just take a couple of examples. Take military power. Europe possesses 21% of the military power in the world today. China possesses 4%. France and Britain alone have larger nuclear forces, larger air forces, larger projectable military manpower than China. Europe has 100,000 troops active in combat positions throughout the world today. China has 2,000. But that's not even Europe's primary comparative advantage globally, because Europe is a modern superpower. Its primary forms of influence are civilian. Europe is the world's largest trading power. Within the WTO, it has a larger role even than the United States. It trades more with a country like China than does the United States. It's the largest trading partner of every country in the Middle East. This is a source of significant influence. It provides 70% of the foreign aid in the world today. It dominates most of the international institutions in the world today. And here's another one that most Americans forget. European values are much more influential in the world today because most new democracies want to be parliamentary democracies, democracies with some sort of social welfare values, rather than more libertarian presidential democracies like the United States. That's why European values and European constitutional patterns tend to dominate when countries write new constitutions. They tend to pattern themselves after countries like Germany or maybe Canada, not the United States. So in all these ways, Europe and the United States, not China, are the countries that are going to dominate at least for another 50 years in the world system, precisely because in the modern international system, it's countries with high per capita incomes and modern societies and economies that can project modern global influence. Mm-hmm.
Well, when you lay it out that way, it seems to make a great deal of sense. I guess I find myself, though, going back to the question about why, given the fact that those are the realities, why it is, though, that we seem to appreciate the significance of Europe, and why it should be that we continue in this kind of sort of older mindset, and we don't pay attention to these things that are clear matters of fact when we start thinking about where the power centers in the world are.
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that people tend to think in old-fashioned terms, as I said, about global power. There's a kind of hypnotic fascination about old-fashioned concepts of that big red country on the map, China, with 1.3 billion people. The truth is China would be a much more powerful country if it only had 300 million relatively wealthy people living on the eastern seaboard and not 700 million more relatively poor people. Why? Because Chinese leaders would then Chinese leaders today have to think primarily about keeping the 700 million people who are poor in China happy. Their domestic legitimacy in China, the domestic legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party, depends on being able to keep the country growing economically and to keep the growth model in place. And that means that China needs economic growth, it needs international interdependence, it needs a peaceful international system, it needs to join the WTO. It can't afford and doesn't need international adventurism of any kind. To put it another way, for countries like that, for almost every country except the poorest of the poor, an active global policy, an active foreign policy has become a luxury good in the international system, a luxury good available only to the high per capita income countries.
And I wonder to what extent the tendency I'm sure of a lot of people in the United States to look at Europe and not see it as some sort of a unified entity, but see it as a collection of countries. countries that are significant and prosperous, to be sure, the UK and Germany and France. But they don't see it as Europe. They see it as those individual countries. And then again, if you then take those countries, Europe, Germany, France, Britain, and set that again aside, India and China, you're back to this thing where you're seduced by the size of the one and the smallness of the other, even though I'm sure individually their economies are very powerful compared with the economy of China. Do we fail to appreciate just how far the Europeans have come in making Europe a kind of political and economic, a big European economic and political kind of unit?
Well, that's a very important point. I think it's hard for Americans to imagine policymaking on a continental scale the way Europeans carry it out. But if you were in the United States Trade Representative's office or in the antitrust division of the Justice Department in the United States, so you had to deal with American trade policy in the WTO or you had to deal with antitrust policy in the United States, you would be thinking about the European Union every day because Europe has one unified trade policy, one unified policy with regard to antitrust policy. If you're thinking about currency in the Federal Reserve, you would realize that Europe has one currency, not all European countries, but most members of the European Union, one currency, the euro. These are essentially unified policies, and they give Europe an extraordinary edge in the world. But even in areas where Europe is not legally unified, it often acts de facto as a single body. One of the things about living in a world that isn't as competitive and warlike as the world was back in the 19th century is that often you don't need complete legal unification in order to generate cooperative policies. I'll give you an example. There is now a European mission in Lebanon led by the French Stabilization Force. Not all European countries are involved in that force because not all European countries are equally interested. The French have a long history there. But nonetheless, it represents Europe. In other European missions elsewhere, other countries are represented. The British were involved in Sierra Leone, for example. But nonetheless, they're able to act in the name of Europe in a flexible way because European countries have sufficiently common interests that even without complete legal unification, they're able to act effectively on the world stage. Mm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Andrew Muravchik. He is professor in the Department of Politics and International Affairs and also director of the European Union Program at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. And he is here to talk about why it is that Europe and not China or India is the second superpower of the 21st century. That's the title of a talk that he'll be giving this afternoon on the U of I campus. He's being hosted here by the European Union Center here at the University of Illinois. He'll be talking this afternoon at 4, and anyone who is interested in stopping by should feel welcome. Here on the program, also questions are welcome too, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. You know, I said just before we started talking here that occasionally I dip into the subject of European politics, but that I feel pretty overwhelmed by this long and sort of tangled story about how they've been moving toward integration. And I think that here in the United States, when we do hear about it, a lot of the coverage seems to be focused on discord rather than coming together. And periodically when certain agreements are being voted on, what we hear about is the people that are saying no. We're not so much hearing about the people who are saying yes. Now, given that is sort of a long and complicated story, what's the important thing for people to know about this effort to unify, to bring these countries together and having not only a unified currency but, you know, other sorts of economic regulations? And then to go beyond that and to have some kind of political, some kind of sense in which they are all acting with one mind, to, you know, as much as that can be when it comes to international politics.
It is a very difficult thing to keep track of this complicated political process because it's unique in the world, an international organization that functions almost as if it were a nation state in certain areas, but is subservient to a set of nation states. So most people, outsiders, but even most Europeans, don't really understand how it works. Now, the truth of the matter is most Americans don't understand how our own government works, you know, how the filibuster works and things like that. But mm-hmm. in Europe, it's doubly complicated because nobody grew up with this system. It seems foreign to them. But there are a couple of things that I think we should always keep in mind about it. The first is that it is a system of institutions, not of individuals. It tends to work very incrementally, very slowly, so that people are always complaining that the individuals who run it, like, for instance, the two relative unknown people who were named to the presidency and the foreign ministry of the foreign minister position of the EU who were recently named pursuant to the recent Treaty of Lisbon, that they created new positions to run their foreign policy in the presidency. The two people named to those positions, Mr. Van Rompuy and Baroness Ashton, were considered non-entities by many people, and many people found that disappointing. But it's quite typical of the European Union that it's a complicated institutional arrangement to generate diplomatic cooperation among 27 countries. It's the institutions that matter, not the individuals. Cooperation tends to come about through a slow, incremental process of cooperation. People are always pessimistic, and then after a long period of time, you get cooperation and everybody's surprised. I'll give you an example. Over the last 20 years, or a little less than that, since the end of the Cold War, there's been an expansion of the European Union from 15 members, basically in Western Europe, to 27 members, stretching all the way to Bulgaria and to Malta in the Mediterranean, with a number of other members in the Balkans and also Turkey still on the list to join the European Union. This is an extraordinary event, right? The expansion of Europe to include almost 600 million citizens, the stabilization, democratization, marketization of a whole series of societies. It's probably the most cost-effective instrument for spreading peace, security, and democracy that any Western government has wielded since the end of the Cold War. And yet it's taken place quietly, incrementally. It's been messy. It's been controversial in Europe. But you wake up one day and you find out there are 27 countries living in a system without borders, many of them with the same currency, all of them with 100,000 pages of the same laws. That's the way the European Union works.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation, someone in Belgium, that is the community, not the country. You're on our line four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I'm sure you considered this in your writings and all, but it just seems that with the power China has, with not only the money that they have sent into the Western world by buying their bonds and whatever other ways to invest in the Western Europe, in Western world, Europe and America, and also the aspect that they provide a workforce that does a lot of the work that the rest of the world really doesn't want to do, in that they do the menial work. They may not do the most scientific work all the time, but they do all the necessary work to make things run along. You know, Walmart wouldn't exist without China. It seems to me they have a huge influence, even though it may not be quite as political as you say.
Well, that's a great comment. It's true that China has been much more integrated into the world economy financially and in terms of trade than it was 20 or 30 years ago. But the question then, as you pose it, is what does that mean for power? Who has power over whom as a result of that integration? And I don't think it's so clear that it's the Chinese who have gained power as a result of that, or in fact that anybody's gained power as a result of that. The first thing we should keep in mind is that it's still true today that the major interdependent relationship in the world is not between the U.S. and China or between anybody and China. It's between the U.S. and Europe. 70% or 60% of global investment in the world remains in the transatlantic and Japanese markets. Most of the interfirm trade takes place in the transatlantic and Japanese markets. Most of global R&D, which is what really drives trade takes place within those markets. Much of Chinese manufacturing is dependent also on that trade. That is to say, firms that are involved in that high technology trade then farm out the production aspects of their final stages of their production to Chinese manufacturers. So there still is much more interdependence between America and Europe, America and Japan, than there is between any of these countries and China. But we don't say, oh, well, we're worried about European power and Japanese power, although we did 20 years ago. But we're much more sanguine about it today. And why? Because we realize nobody's has leverage over anybody else. Instead, we're all interdependent with regard to each other. We all have an incentive to keep this relationship going. And nobody has more of an incentive to do so than China. China has become an extraordinarily interdependent country, a country in which 35% of its GNP is dependent on foreign trade, a much higher number than in the United States. And the Chinese development model for economic growth, and therefore the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party, is dependent on keeping this economic growth and this development model going. Without that, they would be in serious trouble, which is one of the reasons why they're very cautious with regard to things like the reunification with Taiwan or any other kind of external adventurism. It's a reason why they joined the WTO, which was an act of considerable domestic, costly domestic adjustment for them. So this is a healthy relationship that China is more integrated. Similarly, on the financial side, it would be extremely difficult for China actually to use any of the resources that they have to disrupt financial relations with the United States, precisely because it would call into question this economic interdependence. So rather than viewing it as a source of Chinese leverage over the United States or over Europe, which is even more interdependent with the Chinese than we are, we should view it as a guarantee that neither side has an incentive to disrupt current arrangements and a guarantee for a peaceful future.
Well, the only question I have with that, sir, is that if China decides that they don't particularly care for the way things are going on, all they have to do is stop buying our bonds and these wars would quit and our government would quit because they do hold a huge amount of our debt.
They could do that, but they would do that at an enormous cost, right? Because that would have consequences for their currency values. That would have consequences for global financial markets. That would have consequences for our trade policy with regard to their goods. They're more dependent on our trade policy with regard to their goods than we're dependent on, or at least as dependent on our trade policy with regard to their goods as we are dependent on their financial policy with regard to our bonds. And that's the nature of interdependence, is each person is dependent on others.
If I might interject, sir, China many times throughout its history has been a very close society and has done that even at their own disasters and their own problems, and they've done it time and time again.
Well, actually, for most of our history, the United States was a very closed society. In fact, we are the country in the world that is the famous protectionist power for most of our history. But countries can change, and so what we have to assess is whether we think the Chinese government's commitment to liberalization is a credible commitment. And the way we assess whether a country's commitment to something like that is credible is the extent to which they have paid upfront costs to commit to a strategy and whether or not it would be costly for them to change it. You're right about one thing, that if China were to change its strategy to go back to a Maoist strategy of closed economy, nationalist policy, living off the land, then all bets would be off. But that would mean a China in which the current rulers would be deposed, right? So that would be a situation in which an entirely different government would be in power, a situation in which, you know, would be anathema to somebody like Hu Jintao, right? So the Communist Party in China has bet the store on the success of the current policy. They're more at risk than we are. They will lose it all. if the current policy doesn't continue. Now, it's probably prudent for us to hedge against that possibility, which is why we still have military forces in the region. We keep in the back of our minds the possibility that something could happen. But in the medium term, it's our goal to help them develop so that we maintain what is currently a mutually beneficial relationship. So in a sense, you're right in the very long-term future that we have to keep this in the back of our minds, but it's not a near-term likely possibility.
We are at our midpoint. I want to thank the caller. We have some others. Let me just take enough time to introduce again our guest, Andrew Muravchik. He's professor of politics and international affairs and director of the European Union program at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. He is also a non-resident senior fellow of the Brookings Institution, contributing editor of Newsweek magazine, has written quite a lot on European politics and economics, also some about Asia as well. He's visiting the campus. His host here is the European Union Center here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. And he'll be giving a talk talking on just the very subject that we're talking about here this morning. Why is Europe and not China or India the second superpower of the 21st century? This is an event in the MillerCom series. They're always open to anyone who would like to attend. They're free. He'll be talking this afternoon at 4 in the Knight Auditorium, Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. And for us here, of course, questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Next, we'll talk with someone in Indiana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I wonder if you could just give a couple thoughts on the following connection. Right now in the Midwest, Chicago's all been out of shape about they might become a hub for a high-speed train terminal. And you look across the ocean, and they've already done that. And there are a number of things like that throughout since the early 50s that have happened. And I just wonder if it's the psyche of Americans to take these situations like this. And I've always found it quite interesting. One of the reasons they come up for not doing things that in the long run would paid off now, but, you know, still aren't here. And if this has any relationship to your observation about not taking the European Union seriously by some Americans. Thanks.
Right.
Well, I have to say my most striking first image of China was the high-speed train in takes you in from the Shanghai airport. I lived for a year in China. The high-speed train actually was built by Germans, but the Chinese built it as a demonstration of German-Chinese cooperation in from the Shanghai airport. It goes 431 kilometers an hour. It's a maglev train that floats on 10 millimeters of air. It's extraordinary if you ever have a chance to take it. It's probably not cost-effective for long distances, but for short distances, it's really quite extraordinary. China has a remarkable ability to get these kind of public works projects done. They're very pragmatic spirit, and it's in part because it's in a strange way a very new country. China destroyed most of its own history in an odd way in the 20th century. The Cultural Revolution, the Second World War and everything, they started over about 20 years ago. And with an authoritarian government and so on, it's pretty easy for them to do things like build tunnels and roads and trains that many of us find it difficult in the United States to do when we have such paralyzed political institutions and such a history of complex, interconnected life that it's very difficult to build a road from anywhere to anywhere without stepping on a lot of people's feet politically or socially or their property values. So things get done in China, and it's pretty impressive to see how it gets done there. We spoke to a lot of government officials there, they're a very impressive group. Similarly, in Europe, there is a tradition of the state being more effective than in the United States. And one of the consequences of this is that there is a considerable amount of European-Chinese cooperation over regulatory issues, how to regulate certain industrial goods and so on, that Europeans have been much more effective. It's another form of European power, much more effective than Americans at getting Chinese government to accept their industrial standards and their consumer product standards and so on, because they can talk bureaucrat to bureaucrat much more effectively than American officials appear to be able to do. At least that was our impression when we were living for a year in China.
All right. Another caller here. This is someone in Peoria, I think, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hello. Sorry.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Yeah, I kind of, you know, I was going to comment on, you know, something else, but what the gentleman brought up earlier, just now before me, the caller before me, that, you know, it's very expensive around here to build anything when it comes to rails or roads or, you know, even factories. And what I was going to comment was, what I was going to ask you is, I see American factories going over to China, to India, to Japan to build things because it's the money factor. They don't want to pay union fees. You know, if you look at all the stuff that's made in China, it's made for a buck, buck and a half an hour, or, you know, 50 cents an hour or whatever. And that's one of the reasons why they're growing, because everybody in the world wants manufacturing from them. The downfall is, and people, I'm surprised that nobody's brought this up, is the pollution. The amount of pollution that China has is probably the worst in the world. And yet we get hammered on, the United States, because they say we're the worst polluters in the world. I beg to differ. If you look at the Beijing Olympics, they basically halted work in that town for about a month before because of the smog situation. I saw pictures, horrendous pictures of all the water over there. It was yellow and brown and acidy color. I mean, to me, China is its own downfall. Eventually, that's going to catch up to them. America may cost us more to do things here, and we might not be as efficient, say, for instance, as far as rails, but we take care of our environment a lot more. As much as we all argue about how bad we might be, we're still, it's a drop in the bucket compared to what China and some of the Asian countries do. Wouldn't you not agree with this?
Well, you put your finger on a real challenge that the Chinese face, which is that they're a very swiftly growing economy. Like any such developing economy, the pollution problems are very bad and worse in China because they've been so successful and they're relatively industrialized and because of geographical factors there. The question is how we should judge that and what we should do about it. We were a pretty polluted economy, and the British were before us when we were at that stage of development. You do have to remember that, historically speaking, cleaning up the environment, like I was saying before about projecting global power, is a luxury good. You do it after you become developed. I'm not that old, and I can still remember when in Pasadena, California, you couldn't take a deep breath without coughing, right? That wasn't so long ago. And before that, in London, you know, when Sherlock Holmes walked out into the pea soup fog, that was coal smoke because we were polluted. So when we were at the Chinese stage of development, the truth is we were worse than they were. The Chinese have a decent record, not great, but decent record of pollution control given their level of development. And if you go to cities like Shanghai, where I lived for a year, the pollution is bad, but it's not as bad as you would think it is, given a lot of the news reports. And in fact, the Chinese are starting to clean up the eastern seaboard cities and move them into service sector economies, although the western cities are becoming more polluted. So the question is, what's a fair standard for a country that's a low level of development? We can't realistically expect them to be as clean as we are, because we're 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times as rich. And if we want them to be that clean, realistically, or we want them to be as good about global warming as we are, we're realistically going to have to subsidize them to help them to do so. And that's what the Copenhagen negotiations were about, is about whether or not there are going to be subsidies to the developing world, because we have spent 150 years pumping pollutants into the environment, which have created global warming, and we should pay something for that. So there has to be some kind of a compromise here where, on the one hand, there need to be more relaxed standards for China, but on the other hand, China has to do even more than it's doing now to clean up its act. So I think your question is onto something, but the implication that China should be as good as we are is an unrealistic one, and somewhere we need to reach a compromise. And it's a very difficult problem in world politics because it's quite costly for countries to adjust, both China and us, for the reasons you mentioned, jobs and so on. And countries, issues where that much costly adjustment needs to take place are always very, very tough ones for countries to negotiate. But the future of the planet depends on the fact that we do so.
I want to thank the caller. I want to try to get us back to Europe, but I have an email question here I want to do, and it, indeed it is again on China. And the caller, I think, was reflecting on some of the things that you said initially and makes reference to a story that was published in the New York Times in last December. And it's not the only story like this that one sees about the fact that China is involved in doing construction and development work. And I know particularly this is in the developing world. I've been very big in Africa. So the email references hundreds of thousands of Chinese workers working abroad, and they're doing things like building power plants and factories and railroads and highways and subway lines and stadiums, to quote the Times story. And the question that the person poses is, well, isn't this every bit a projection of power as supporting military operations in the field?
Yeah, it is. China, insofar as it engages in economic activities abroad, does focus largely on Africa and does focus largely on public works. But compared to the activities of Western multinationals abroad, compared to foreign aid by Western multinationals abroad, compared to the activities of international organizations largely dominated by Westerners, largely Europeans, compared to trade with Western countries, is a drop in the bucket.
Mm-hmm. To Urbana for another caller here, line one.
Hello.
Yes.
The discussion seems to have been focusing largely on China for a while, and I think your thesis is well supported there. I do have a question about the ability of this country to maintain its position as a world power, though. It seems to me that infrastructure and particularly education are paramount to our doing so. And yet we seem reluctant, particularly, to support education. California, which once led the world in its educational system, has slipped to the point where it's in danger of approaching third world level if they're not very careful. Well, I'm exaggerating. But we seem to have a dysfunctional government. And my critique is not that of the right wing, but that it is altogether too easy for a minority to block all progressive legislation. Would you care to comment on some of these?
Well, I would like to take the discussion back to Europe here. I think that often you hear criticisms of Europe as dysfunctional in precisely this way. And I think, you know, every government in the world, the Chinese one, the American one, the European governments, the EU has its own pathologies of various kinds. But I think in many respects, Europe looks good when it comes to effective provision of public services. Now, I would say actually education, for all its faults, is an area where at least higher education is something where the U.S. Doesn't look half bad. I mean, we spend more money than as percentage of GDP than any other advanced industrial country, and we get something for it. It's still striking, though, that Europe, when it comes to global power projection, Europe educates four times as many third country students, that means students from outside of Europe, than does the United States. Perhaps MIT, University of Illinois, other top universities may be in certain areas stronger, but still Europe is doing much more for many more students than is the United States. And there are many other areas in which European governance models, the way Europe governs itself, are viewed around the world as much more attractive models. As I said, most countries designing constitutions in the world choose European institutions, parliamentary government, restrictions on money in politics, and things like that as part of their constitutional structure rather than American equivalents, global standards of human rights, things like that. So I think in many respects, European political institutions are in fact models for the world.
We have as our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Andrew Muravchuk, who will be here for about another 10 minutes in this hour of Focus. He's professor of politics and international affairs and director of the European Union program at Princeton University's Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. He also has taught at Harvard. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be talking about this subject, that is, how Europe fits into the global political system. Questions welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just something I'd like to return to for a little bit. You were talking earlier about the fact that the European Union does in fact have this administrative structure. It has a parliament. It has an executive. Now, again, though, I think when we hear about European politics, what we hear about is the governments of the individual countries and their leadership. How have they managed to sort out this relationship between the individual governments, who certainly have all their own individual concerns, and the idea that there is this central administrative authority and that there is this idea that they're trying to act in some unified fashion?
Well, this is the big question of European integration, because the member states of the European Union, there are now 27 of them. And imagine a system in which 27 governments representing states that are remarkably diverse, all the way from Sweden down to Malta, from Bulgaria to Portugal, Ireland, are all trying to make policy within a system. And a system that needs to be, because these are after all nation states, needs to be relatively solicitous of their individual concerns. Mm-hmm. And yet, the system seems to work. It manages to generate a remarkable amount of economic legislation. It has a single currency. It's eliminated borders between European states. It's done a remarkable – it has common agricultural policy. In many areas, it's generated effective foreign policy efforts. And perhaps most strikingly in the last decade, it's enlarged itself in a relatively multicultural way to include countries that have rather different political traditions, in some cases ethnic traditions, than the countries in the core, France, Germany, countries in the core of the old Europe. It does this by governing in a relatively decentralized but consensual way. It's in a strange way a lot like the United States, particularly the United States in the 19th century, a very consensual balance, checks and balances kind of polity, in which it takes a long time for legislation to pass. A lot of people get a say in it. Implementation of legislation tends to be decentralized in the member states. There's a lot of attention to trying to make sure everybody's on board. And the result of this is that it's often frustrating, incremental, slow to get things done. But when they get done, people tend to be relatively pleased with the results. So the system has evolved in this way, and it's relatively effective. And the key to it is that the European Union is governing a continent of relatively small and extremely interdependent countries. Mm. So Americans cannot imagine what it would be like to live in a country like Belgium where imports plus exports are over 100% of GDP. So this is a country where living without cooperation of other countries is unthinkable, and therefore countries are forced to find effective means of cooperation.
You have talked a couple of times, made reference to how it is that over time the numbers of countries that belong have grown, and the fact that there are also some other countries that would like to join. At least there were some people in those countries that would like to join. One of those is Turkey. After some seemingly initial burst of enthusiasm both in Europe and in Turkey about that possibility, it seems to have become much more complicated and much more controversial Do you think eventually Turkey will join?
Very tough question. Depends on the evolution of politics within Turkey, which is not yet a stable democratic system and is still a developing country. Depends on political evolution within the European Union, where, to put it charitably, enlargement of the European Union to include Turkey is not a popular thing. In fact, in many countries, it has single-digit public opinion support. I think European leaders, all 27 of them, have been extraordinarily courageous, or shall we call it enlightened, in pursuing Turkish enlargement, keeping it on the agenda, despite the fact public opinion support is not strong. And I have been critical, publicly and privately, of American policymakers whose attitude I think is somewhat condescending toward their European counterparts. They constantly say we should send over officials to strengthen the back of our European counterparts, get them to see what important strategic opportunity Turkey is, get them to hurry up with Turkish enlargement. How many politicians do you know who will pursue an issue year in and year out over determined opposition when there's only single-digit public opinion support? In fact, European leaders are doing a very brave and enlightened thing as best they can. And I think it's rather presumptuous of us to say, they're not doing a good enough job. They're doing what they can, and we'll see how it comes out.
Other callers here. In about 5 minutes left, we'll go next to Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I have a question about a current controversy that's going on right now in Europe. There's a measure to force the removal of crucifixes from classrooms and, I believe, other public places. And it's meeting some resistance from some of the countries. It seems a little draconian, but I'm just wondering, how do you think that'll turn out?
Well, I don't try to predict the outcome of particular issues like that, but it's a good example of the kind of issue that, in general, Europe does not deal with. And so normally those issues are compromised away, permitting individual countries to resolve them in their own way. The EU generally does not deal with issues of religion or culture. It doesn't try to homogenize the languages of Europe. In fact, the principle of the European Union is unity in diversity. And there's a much stronger emphasis on diversity than there is in many nation states that have a common language and a common heritage, often hundreds of years of history. There has to be, because they're made up of nation states with very different heritages, and in this case, religious heritages and political heritages. So in France, for example, the tradition is strict separation of church and state, so that you would not bring crucifixes into public spaces, whereas in other countries, you have a much closer connection between church and state, so that you have official religions. Or you have a much closer connection. In some countries, this is not even a national decision. It's a local decision, as in Germany. So this is the kind of issue that it seems to me it's generally inappropriate to be decided on a continental level. And generally, the solution of an institution like the EU is to fudge it and let it be decided at another level. And that's normally the way a federal system should resolve these issues.
Okay. One more caller here in Champaign County, line 1. Hello.
Hi. This is too complicated to bring up in 5 minutes, but I wasn't able to get to a call. But, people are reacting like this is alien to them. It seems to me that it's a nuanced argument, and I'd like to make one too, but in the short moments here, the U.S. is a company of rivals. There have been, pretty hard-put rivalries between Europe and the U.S., and people know about it at other levels, it seems to me. And I think there is planning for that sort of thing. But it's also the case that, we sort of have a joint imperial project, and I'm pointing at Afghanistan. This is also not something that's talked about much, but you can go to Hans von Schäfer's former NATO head's speech before the Foreign Policy, not Foreign Policy Magazine, but the Foreign Affairs, Council of Foreign Relations, that's at CFR, and find that he frankly admits that you know, this is a strategic part of the world, and that's another reason why we need to have influence there. And it's kind of surreal in some ways too, because we have NATO troops guarding Chinese firms mining copper in Afghanistan. So the things fall out at some point, but there's a collusion of interest at this point. And it just seems to me that it's a much more nuanced argument to make. I also would like to say that I do share your opinion of Europe as being more sophisticated but you know, some people in the left in Europe call the current arrangement for federation son of Bolkestein, because it's such a business club of harmonization.
Yeah, we just got about a minute. I appreciate the caller, and he made a number of interesting points, and you can take about a minute to respond as you like.
I'd like to pick up on just one point. One anecdote you mentioned, which I think pretty much summarizes the way I see the modern world evolving. There's a United States operation in Afghanistan with EU support on the civilian side, in which NATO troops, which are 40% European, are guarding Chinese mining concerns. That'd be the modern world.
Well, we're at the point we must stop, because we've come to the end of the time. For people who were in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Andrew Mrabchik, he'll be speaking on the subject, Why is Europe and not China or India the second superpower of the 21st century? This is an event in the MillerCom series, and all of these are free and open to the public. He'll be speaking this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory Street in Urbana. So 4 o'clock this afternoon, anybody who'd like to attend should feel that they are welcome. They're free and open to the public. He's being hosted here by the European Union Center here on our campus. And he is in the Department of Politics, International Affairs at Princeton. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.